This is the India Migration Now Extra. Hello, listeners, to India Migration Now Extra. In the course of our work at India Migration Now, we get to interact with some really compelling and interesting people. Some of these are experts in academics, featured in our India Migration Now podcast series, but also industry leaders and migrants and people on the ground who work day in, day out with migrants. Also employers and other members of the private sector. Just a whole body of people we've been very fortunate to interact with day to day for our work. Through India Migration Now Extra, we want to bring these conversations to you. In today's episode, we are joined by an absolute authority on international migration, a migrant himself from rural Odisha, Dr. Dilip Ratha, the head of NOMAD, housed within the World Bank. He's written and researched on remittances, international migration, and implications of development for many, many years now. His team at the World Bank is at the forefront of research and knowledge on migration. It was an absolute honor having him for this first edition of India Migration Extra.
Thank you, Dilip, for joining us. It's a real honor for India Migration Now to have you on our podcast.
Thank you, Varun. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. So let's just start off with a discussion on one of the key sort of stylized facts in the literature, international migration, or tourism, in fact, is as countries develop and approach middle-income status, international cross-border migration increases. I want to explore the implications of this for developing countries in the global south, and what steps can they take to maximize the developmental impact of these increased migration flows?
Quickly on the maximizing developmental impact. One is that, you know, there are three sustainable development goals that directly address migration. One is to increase the volume of remittances. The second one is to reduce the cost of sending money, which is remittances. And the third one is to promote safe migration, labor migration, by reducing the recruitment costs for low-skilled migrant workers.
Right.
So these three things are very important, and I'll talk more about that. One thing that has not been in the picture too much, but we sense that in the last 5 years, that phenomenon is going to has become serious enough to garner attention is return migration.
Right.
You know, just to give you an example, the Syrians and a whole bunch of them that came to Germany and Europe. Many of them, more than a million of them, applied for asylum, and most of the applications have been rejected.
Right.
So that is just the tip of the iceberg. The return migration phenomenon is going to increase, which means that developing countries, which will get these people back, their own people back, they will have to prepare for large return migration and to reintegrate them. So these are three things I mentioned there: increasing volume of remittances, reducing remittance costs, reducing recruitment costs, and then the fourth thing was reintegration efforts to take the people back if they are coming back. And the fifth thing would be then improving data on migration and migration's benefits so that we all talk with facts rather than perceptions and myths.
Absolutely. And given, I mean, that's a very comprehensive picture, and thank you for that. And I'm just like, in India right now, we are in the middle of a, you know, public consultation on our new immigration policy framework, on our new immigration bill. And I was wondering, in general, for net migrant sending countries like India, Bangladesh, Philippines, what are some, I mean, you scoped out the areas where work is needed. Are there any specific policy initiatives that we need to take to manage immigration better and promote and protect the welfare of our migrants abroad?
Well, I mean, a number of thoughts come there. You know, first, if we take the topic of immigration, people coming in to countries like India, let's say.
Right.
But, you know, we one of the stylized facts that has not been reflected sufficiently in policy making, global policy making, is that south-south migration is larger than south-north migration.
Right.
That largest migration corridor in the world might be, let's say, Bangladesh to India rather mm-hmm. than Mexico to the US. The migration from sub-Saharan African countries into South Africa is significantly large. And, right. you know, intra-African migration is like two-thirds of all African migration.
Right.
So south-south migration is larger, and that a lot of countries like India, South Africa, Russia, Malaysia, these are developing countries that receive a large number of migrants. Migration is actually pervasive. It's
right.
there everywhere.
Right.
So if we are now thinking about people in our own country as foreigners, we also have to then remember that our people abroad are also foreigners in those countries.
Right.
So if we expect our people to be treated very well by foreign countries, I think we should mirror that in treating foreigners in our country.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a general principle. And yet that is easier said than done in democracies where majority and numbers matter, majority in specific places matter for local
right.
governance.
Right.
Because, you know, if you have more than 51% people or even sometimes 30% people voting for one candidate, that candidate might win. So numbers have consequences in terms of political power and political governance, as well as the social contract with people.
Correct.
Now, on the social contract aspect, you know, the fear that migrants take away jobs, they overwhelm our schools and hospitals, these have been time and again proven to be untrue. They do come in numbers, but really, they also bring a lot of resources. And it is not really clear on the net whether they overwhelm anything or they actually contribute to the local governance, to the local health system's ability to pay for services, or the, you know, the schools as well. At the national level, there is very little evidence that migrants overwhelm anything. They are a net positive contributor.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, one of the things I wanted to explore with you was in India, we have a very sort of bipolar attitude towards migration, where we have an extremely positive perception of our NRIs and immigrants, you know, abroad in general, but an increasingly despondent, hostile perception of internal migrants and immigrants. Why do you think that is the case, given the positive that immigrants bring to even South countries?
This is the classic, you know, paradox. That is why I started by saying that we should not have double standards.
Right.
You know, we can't expect to be treated very well abroad, and then we won't treat people well in our own place.
Right.
The issue is not that simple, because, you know, for whatever reason, people have a sense of space, and people have a sense of private property and or sometimes even national identity.
Right.
And this is where facts can help take some of the myths. But this issue is not going away anytime. The most important roadblock to sensible migration policy making, as opposed to, let's say, sensible trade policy making,
right.
Is this fact that migration brings people, and people have rights, and people also command sympathy, and sometimes the opposite behavior. So that issue is not simple to deal with, but I think we can take away some parts, some elements of that fear of foreigners,
right?
By pointing out that just as Indians abroad are there, let's say in the Gulf countries, to make a living and help the families back home to find a job for themselves, and help family survive back home, and even prosper in some cases after a while.
Right.
The same way, foreigners in countries like India or in South Africa are trying to do exactly the same thing. So we know this, that Kerala people are in Gulf countries.
Right.
And then you have Biharis and UP people in Kerala.
Of course.
Nicaraguans have, so El Salvador people, a whole bunch of them are in actually Washington, D.C. area.
Right.
But then doing the same job now back home are Nicaraguans in those countries.
I see.
And when the Nicaraguans are going to El Salvador, people from outside the capital city are actually migrating locally, meaning internally within Nicaragua, to go to the capital city to do the same jobs. So it's a cascading migration of sorts. We know this.
Right.
So this phenomenon has to be approached from that viewpoint that there is more reason is needed, more facts are needed for right. fact-based, evidence-based policy making.
Right.
So that would be sort of the broader thing about immigration part of it.
Given you scoped out a broad areas where we need to work, I'm just wondering if you have any specific policy ideas which could help India take care of its migrants better. Are there any lessons we can learn from other countries, perhaps?
Sure. I mean, one of the important things that I would encourage everyone to do in thinking about immigration policy is to understand the migration cycle. So, you know, cycle, you don't know where the beginning and where the end is, but right. let's say we begin by looking at people wanting to migrate. So there is a visa policy, there is a passport issuance policy.
Right.
And prior to that, the birth record, death record kind of thing, and ID and all that. Then there is a transmission process. So, you know, how will they travel? And, you know, there is a huge problem with the travel part of it, or just people being sourced to go to the destination countries. That process is highly, highly flawed. It has ranged in the past from slavery to these days smuggling and recruitment malpractices.
Right.
So there are people, recruitment agencies, sourcing these people, taking them abroad. They don't get what they are promised. Their passports are withheld. They are sometimes abused. And then at some point, suddenly they lose their contract, or sometimes with anticipation or with notice, they lose their contract. Then they don't want to come back. They become undocumented.
Right.
Then there is the whole process of return.
Yes.
And the return migration part is really a black box. Most people don't know what is going on there, and nobody has factored that in. So first point I would say is to understand the migration cycle and make immigration policy for India, keeping in mind that it's a full cycle that we need to address in the policy framework. Okay.
Right.
So then just in terms of sourcing the people, or when people are beginning to travel, I mean, facilitate the visa passport process, and the passport issuance process has improved significantly. But I was recently in Kerala about a month ago, and there was a lady from, I believe, from Meghalaya or something. And she was saying that she has been waiting for a passport for a year. That was a surprise to me, because from everyone I hear, getting a passport in India is really, really easy.
Right.
But this lady says she's been waiting more than a year to get a visa. She was, actually, I found a lot of people from Northeast in Kerala working there.
Right.
And they don't want to stay there forever. So there is that issue of making, you know, the process simpler for Indians to go abroad. One of the issues that comes up again and again is migrants not knowing their rights and not having the proper training when they go abroad.
Right.
So basic things like some language training, some training about their rights and responsibilities can go a long way. And some people call it pre-departure training. That can help
yes.
a lot in terms of helping the migrant process, and then also integration back, you know, in the countries over there. That brings an interesting point. When these people arrive and they're working in the foreign countries, I think our embassies abroad and consulates abroad could do a lot better in terms of thinking of providing services to all kinds of migrants, not only to the rich and famous, but right. to the masses. And Indian consulates abroad, embassies abroad, should be equipped with the resources, people, as well as money and technology and communication equipment to deal with these people. And I think there is a lot that can be learned from rich countries in that process.
Right.
And then there's the question of return and reintegration back home. That ought to be also thought through. That's basically a few points that comes to mind right away. But, you know, in immigration policy making, the most important aspect, most important thing that I would highlight is that we are dealing with people.
Right.
And these are people who are not necessarily the doctors and engineers and economists like me.
Yeah.
They are also the millions of people who actually are not so high skilled, not so highly skilled in terms of training. And yet, they are the ones who send 80-90% of what they earn back home.
Right.
And the entire amount of the $80 billion remittances that India is receiving this year,
yes.
Most of it, actually more of it, comes from this relatively lower skilled migrant workers. So we need to think of them as really a significant resource for India.
I mean, just on that point quickly, I mean, one thing we noticed with immigration policy frameworks, not just in India, abroad, is a focus on workers. And as you said, it has to be focusing on all workers. But what about the families who joined them and students and other forms of emigration? You think an immigration policy framework should capture and take care of them also?
Of course. And one of the studies in Belgium we conducted of Congolese and Nigerian and Senegalese diasporas
right.
in Belgium. That right. was about a decade ago.
Right.
One surprising finding to me, which is not in the public discourse or in the literature, was that every adult member of the family was sending money home. So we think of the household
wow.
as one person sending money home,
right?
And we focus on that person typically in the Indian context and in the GCC, the Gulf context. It would be a male member of the family.
Right.
But actually, every man and so husband as well as wife are sending money home to different people and different channels. And even the adult children send money home. So this is a... You are right. I think we have to focus on all kinds of migrants going out, family members as well as students. Now, students have a very specific they have specific needs, I think.
Mm-hmm.
One huge issue with students going abroad is sending money for them for their survival out there.
Right.
That phenomenon of people going abroad on using a larger and larger amount of own resources as opposed to getting scholarship abroad is going to increase in India now. India, as it is getting into the middle income group,
yes.
lower middle income now, more and more people are going to go abroad to study, and their needs will be different in different countries. So, and they, by the way, can bring a huge amount of benefits if they can be encouraged to stay engaged in India, whether they come back or whether they stay abroad. If there is a way we can keep them connected to India, that would go a long way.
I noticed one thing, just to end this on a light sort of moment, was I saw you on the Twitter that you've been retweeting Pico Iyer's quotes. And I was wondering if one thing we do ask our guests is there something you read around migration? Is there something on your book or on your desk you're reading about migration? If you have something specific that you can recommend to the readers, to the listeners, I should say.
I'm afraid not right away. I mean, Pico Iyer is, he was at the TED global conference in Rio where I spoke.
Right.
And after I spoke, he came to me and said, you are a true poet, my friend, or something like that.
Excellent.
And then he wrote a book on I think, stillness.
Yes.
That was a TED book.
Yes.
Where they asked me to, he and the TED people asked me to write a commentary on that, a blurb.
Right.
And I really appreciated his talk, TED talk actually, on what is home.
Ah, I see.
Home is where you are comfortable. That's how he puts it.
Right.
He's a much traveled person, as you know, and a philosopher of sorts. Now, you asked me about books. I mean, I'll think about what I'm reading these days, but what is preoccupying me right now is this whole question of large movement of people,
right?
Which I mentioned before. You know, if 266 million migrants, the stock of it is causing us to rethink globalization and causing sort of major changes in countries' politics and politics.
Right.
Then, if the number quadruples or triples or doubles, we are looking at a tsunami of much more gigantic proportions than what climate change would bring.
Right.
That is what is preoccupying me, and I'm beginning to think, you know, what could be the solution to that. I haven't made a lot of headway. I mean, but that's what I'm worried about. How to manage very large and unanticipated migration flows? That's the question that is keeping me awake at night sometimes.
That's a large question indeed, and I wish you and your team the absolute luck for the sake of the world in many ways, because you're at the forefront of this research. Thank you. Dilip, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.